Please turn in your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 26. And I am going to begin this morning by reading the chapter. So follow along as I read 1 Samuel 26, beginning with verse 1. Then the Ziphites came to Saul at Gibeah, saying, "Is not David hiding himself on the hill of Hakilah, which is on the east of Jeshimon?" So Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph with about 3,000 chosen men of Israel to seek David in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul encamped on the hill of Hakilah, which is beside the road on the west side of Jeshimon. But David remained in the wilderness. When he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness, David sent out spies and learned that Saul had indeed come. Then David rose and came to the place where Saul had encamped. And David saw the place where Saul lay with Abner, the son of Ner, the commander of his army. Saul was lying within the encampment while the army was encamped around him. Then David said to Ahimelech the Hittite and to Joab's brother, Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, "Who will go down with me into the camp to Saul?" And Abishai said, "I will go down with you." So David and Abishai went to the army by night, and there lay Saul sleeping within the encampment, with his spear stuck in the ground at his head, and Abner and the army lay around him. Then Abishai said to David, "God has given your enemy into your hand this day. Now please let me pin him to the earth with one stroke of the spear, and I will not strike him twice." But David said to Abishai, "Do not destroy him. For who can put out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless?" And David said, "As the Lord lives, the Lord will strike him, or his day will come to die, or he will go down into battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should put out my hand against the Lord's anointed. But take now that spear that is at his head and the jar of water, and let us go." So David took the spear and the jar of water from Saul's head, and they went away. No man saw it or knew it, nor did any awake, for they were all asleep, because a deep sleep from the Lord had fallen upon them. Then David went over to the other side and stood far off on the top of the hill with a great space between them. And David called to the army and to Abner, the son of Ner, saying, "Will you not answer, Abner?" Then Abner answered, "Who are you who calls to the king?" And David said to Abner, "Are you not a man? Who is like you in Israel? Why then have you not kept watch over your lord, the king? For one of the people came in to destroy the king, your lord. This thing that you have done is not good. As the Lord lives, you deserve to die because you have not kept watch over your Lord, the Lord's anointed. And now see where the king's spear is and the jar of water that was at his head." Saul recognized David's voice and said, "Is this your voice, my son David?" And David said, "It is my voice, my lord, O king." And he said, "Why does my lord pursue after his servant? For what have I done? What evil is on my hands? Now, therefore, let my lord the king hear the words of his servant. If it is the Lord who has stirred you up against me, may he accept an offering. But if it is men, May they be cursed before the Lord, for they have driven me out this day, that I should have no share in the heritage of the Lord, saying, go, serve other gods. Now, therefore, let not my blood fall to the earth away from the presence of the Lord. For the king of Israel has come out to seek a single flea like one who hunts a partridge in the mountains. Then Saul said, I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will no more do you harm, because my life was precious in your eyes this day. Behold, I have acted foolishly, and I have made great mistakes. And David answered and said, here is the spear, O king. Let one of the young men come over and take it. The Lord rewards every man for his righteousness and his faithfulness. For the Lord gave you into my hand today, and I would not put out my hand against the Lord's anointed. Behold, as your life was precious this day in my sight, so may my life be precious in the sight of the Lord, and may he deliver me out of all tribulation. Then Saul said to David, blessed be you, my son David. You will do many things and will succeed in them. So David went his way, and Saul returned to his place. Now, before we start to work through the text, I want to take you back briefly to chapter 24. And if you were with us 2 weeks ago, you'll recall that we had a similar situation there, where David had an opportunity to kill Saul. But David resisted that temptation, although he did cut off a piece of Saul's robe. And then later, from a distance, he showed it to Saul to let him know that he could have killed him, but that he had instead spared his life. And then in response, Saul said some things to David that must have encouraged him, as though they were making some progress, that things were moving in the right direction between the two of them. Well, first of all, Saul wept. And David might have at least hoped that these were tears of remorse, of repentance. And then Saul acknowledged that David had behaved more righteously than he had, and that his own actions had been evil. Saul marveled that anyone would do what David had done, to have an opportunity to kill his enemy and yet restrain himself from doing so. And he asked that the Lord would reward David for what David had done. And then, perhaps most surprisingly, he openly acknowledged that David would be king of Israel. Now, we should probably note that David did not go back to Gibeah with Saul. Saul went home, but David and his men then left for the stronghold. So despite everything that Saul had just said, David was still cautious at this point. And yet, even if he wasn't ready to trust Saul with his life, David had to have hoped that the worst of all of this was behind him, that they had turned a corner, and that his days of escaping through windows and sleeping in caves and always being just one step ahead of death were coming to an end. Well, that sets up our chapter this morning, which opens with the Ziphites coming to Saul at his home in Gibeah and telling him where David was hiding. So we're going to call the first 5 verses of this chapter the setback. David has had this issue that he's been dealing with for a while, that Saul was seeking his life. And David had, at least for the most part, been faithful through all of this. Although it was really God who had been faithful to David. God had strengthened him. God had sustained him. God had delivered him from Saul. But now, when it seemed that the trial might have been coming to an end, David experienced this setback. And David found himself right back in the thick of it. And so here, before we start to break down the text, I want to set up the application, the takeaway. Because you have had to deal with trials in your life. And some of you are dealing with trials right now. You may have stumbled. You may have been faithful. But God has sustained you through all of them, through your trials. And at some point, perhaps, you think that your trials are coming to an end. And then there's a setback. Now, it may have been health-related. You'd been dealing with some kind of medical issue, and you thought that you'd gotten on top of it, that things were resolved. You'd experienced healing, and then you get the hard news from your doctor, and everything comes crashing down around you. Or maybe it was financial. You've been trying to dig out of a hole, and you're starting to see the light. And then some unexpected bill or unforeseen expense erases all of your hard work. Or it could be relational, where you've been working hard to repair a damaged relationship, and you think that you've got past the worst of it, that you've resolved the issues, and then something blows up again, and you're right back where you started. Or any of 100 other things. And when we find ourselves in that kind of situation, we can look to David in this passage and see an example of a man who had a setback and yet was steadfast, even though he thought, or at least hoped, that his trial was coming to an end, only to be disappointed. And so we begin with the Ziphites. The Ziphites were the people who lived in the town of Ziph, which was next to the wilderness where David was hiding. These are the same Ziphites who had betrayed David to Saul back in chapter 23. And that was the time where David was on the verge of being captured. Saul and his armies were closing in on David and his men. And then God, at the last minute, had providentially caused the Philistines to raid Israel and had forced Saul to call off the pursuit. But what makes it even worse with these Ziphites is that Ziph is a Judean town. These people were from the tribe of Judah, which was David's tribe. David was being betrayed by those who, of all of the people in Israel, you would have expected to be loyal to him. And then when Saul got this information about David and about his whereabouts, he didn't waste any time. He got up immediately and went out to seek him. There doesn't appear to be any internal conflict, no wrestling, no introspection here. If Saul had ever been serious about stopping his persecution of David, it's obvious that he'd gotten over it by this point. And so Saul took 3,000 chosen men, just like he had before, and he set out to find David. And David, if you remember, has about 600 men. And they're not chosen. At least they're not chosen by David. They were just a ragtag group of distressed men, many of whom had only joined David because they didn't have anywhere else to go. They didn't have any other prospects. And it says in verse 3 that David saw that Saul came after him. And that's one of the things when you have 3,000 men. You may have a superior fighting force, at least in human terms, but you aren't going to sneak up on anyone. So David saw this army coming, and he sent out spies to confirm what he really already knew, that it was indeed Saul. David apparently was able to move around the wilderness a little more stealthily than Saul and his men were. So David went to where Saul was camped. And this would have been at night. And Saul was asleep in the center of the camp. He was there with Abner, his commander, nearby, and all of the army surrounding him. Well, maybe Saul still had in mind that episode in the cave where he had exposed himself to David and his men, where he was there and he didn't have any of his guard around, and he was determined that he wasn't going to allow that to happen again. And so here he is asleep, about as safe as a man could possibly be while out on an expedition of this nature. So picture David. David is standing up on a hill, looking out over this army of 3,000 soldiers camped before him. And it wasn't just that the army was five times the size of David's army. They were also better trained and better equipped. And their sole purpose for being there was capturing and killing David. So this was a bit of a setback for David. And what did he do? He persevered. Although the real test of his perseverance would come a couple of verses later. But that's our heading for verses 6 through 12. David's perseverance. He said to the men who were with him, to Ahimelech and Abishai, he said, "Who wants to go down to camp with me?" And we'll find out later that Abishai is David's nephew. And it's Abishai who says, "Yeah, I'll go along with you." Now, I don't know what David is thinking at this point. And I don't mean that in a critical sense. I don't know what he was expecting. As far as we know, God hadn't told him to go into camp. And so I don't know what he was thinking was going to happen when he got there. So he went down with Abishai. And they went to where Saul lay asleep. And there was that spear. Saul doesn't seem to go anywhere without that spear. We first saw it back in chapter 18. David was playing for Saul. He'd been recruited to play his lyre for Saul when Saul was being tormented by a harmful spirit. And the text says that Saul had his spear in his hand, and then that Saul hurled the spear at David. And the impression that we get here is that it wasn't that Saul had brought the spear along in order to throw it at David. He just carried the spear around the palace. We saw it again in chapter 19. He had his spear in his hand as he was listening to David play. And again, in the following verse, we see that he hurled it at David. Apparently, he kept it with him when he was feasting as well. Because in chapter 20, when he became angry at his son Jonathan at the new moon feast, he had his spear handy to hurl at him as well. And then in chapter 22, Saul was sitting up on the hill. It says up on the height. He was sitting under a tamarisk tree, and he's brooding because he doesn't know where David is. And he's got his spear in his hand. And that's when somebody comes and tells him that they've located David. It seems to be his thing that he carried around that spear. And in a way, it symbolizes his power. And it becomes the instrument of his aggression. So David and Abishai came to where Saul was asleep, and there was his spear stuck in the ground at his head. And Abishai said to David, "God has given your enemy into your hand this day. Now please, let me pin him to the earth with one stroke of the spear. I will not need to strike him twice." It's no coincidence that twice earlier, Saul had tried to pin David to the wall with that very spear. And then here, Abishai offers to pin Saul to the ground with it. In all likelihood, Abishai knew of the stories. He'd heard of Saul trying to pin David to it. Our narrator obviously knows about this. And the poetic justice of having Saul meet his end that way would not have been lost on them. So David is being tempted here with Saul's power and Saul's aggression. And David wouldn't even need to do the deed himself. Just say the word. Just give the command, and Saul would be dead, and David would become the new king of Israel. This right here is the real test of David's perseverance. Because perseverance, in the biblical sense, is not just hanging in there. It's not just keeping your chin up when things get tough. Perseverance is staying true to the path that you have committed to, especially in the face of temptation to abandon it. David had committed to not raising his hand against Saul because that restraint was the righteous thing to do. We saw that back in chapter 24. David said, "I will not raise my hand against the Lord's anointed." But where had that gotten David? It got him nowhere, it seemed. Saul wasn't going to change. And if it wasn't obvious before, it certainly was now. It would have been so easy for David just to say, okay, just to nod his approval to Abishai and escape, at least for a time, from all of his troubles. It's not so different for us. You've made a commitment to do what you know is right, to meet whatever obligations you have to the best of your ability, to treat people with grace regardless of how they treat you, to trust God no matter what. But it hasn't gotten any easier as you hoped that it would. And it would be so easy to give in. And maybe it would feel so good just to submit to the temptation. But David said, no, we're not going to do that. Do not destroy him. For who can put out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? He would not veer from the path of righteousness that he had chosen. And he was not going to reevaluate his position while he stood there in the dark with Abishai. And that's important. You cannot stand in the dark at the moment of decision and reconsider your options. Whatever was right in the daylight is right in the dark. And then look what David says in verse 10. He said, "As the Lord lives, the Lord will strike him, or his day will come to die, or he will go down into battle and perish." In other words, God will take care of it. David didn't know how. Maybe the Lord would intervene directly and supernaturally and strike Saul down at some point. Or maybe, in God's providence, Saul would die of natural causes on his appointed day. Or maybe God would use a battle to do it. David didn't know. God hadn't told him. But David trusted God to know. He trusted God to act according to God's will, according to the plan that God had in place. And David was completely comfortable with that arrangement. Alistair Begg says, "There was a principle to hold and a providence to look to." We are responsible for the principle. I am, and you are, and David was. We are called to act righteously. And that's all. The providence is up to God. And we can trust that God has that under control. And then David repeated, he would not violate God's righteous standard. He would not raise his hand against the Lord's anointed. But that spear and the jar of water next to Saul's head, take those, he said, and let's go. And then we learn how it was that they were able to infiltrate the camp without being discovered. A deep sleep from the Lord had fallen upon all of the army. And of course, that was part of God's providence as well. So then here the scene shifts. David put some distance between himself and Saul and his men before he called out to them. And here we see an exchange that we're going to consider under the heading encouragement. And it's interesting that when David called out, he didn't address Saul directly, but instead called out to Abner. There was really no point in talking to Saul, as David had already found out. And so he called to Abner, "Will you not answer, Abner?" Now, David and Abner would have known each other well. They had a history. Abner was there when David killed Goliath. And then Abner and David would have worked closely together. They would have fought together when David was still in Saul's good graces. And perhaps David thought Abner might advocate for him, or at least restrain Saul in some way. But if that was David's thinking, Abner's response, "Who are you who calls to the king?" puts an end to it quickly. Well, first of all, Abner knew who David was. He's not asking the question, "Who are you?" He's just being dismissive here. And second, Abner's answer defers to the king. "Who are you to call to the king?" Well, David ignored this, and he continued to address Abner. Abner was a courageous and mighty warrior. "Who is like you in Israel?" David asked. Saul trusted him, apparently, at least as much as Saul trusted anyone. And Abner was sort of like a human version of Saul's spear. He represented Saul's power, and Saul used him as an instrument of his aggression. And yet, when it came down to it, Abner was unable to protect Saul. That's David's point here. Men can take whatever precautions they want and go to whatever lengths they can to accomplish their own ends. But no matter how powerful that man might be, when God decides differently, men are utterly powerless against him. And then David chided Abner a bit about his failure. He said that Abner deserved to die for his failure to protect the king. But it's the last line of verse 16 where we find the encouragement in this. And now we see where the king's spear is and the jar of water that was at his head. Ralph Davis really emphasizes this point. Look at the evidence of what God has done for encouragement during difficult times. In many ways, very little has changed for David. He's still staring down an army many times the size of his own and better equipped and better trained. The king of the land is still intent on killing him. The Ziphites, his own tribe's members, were betraying him again. And yet look where the king's spear is. It's in David's hand. The image of Saul's power and aggression. God had handed it to David. And where is the king's water jar? The source of his sustenance. David had that too. David was able to walk into Saul's camp and take these things from beside the king's head. What could have been more unlikely than that? And yet God had done it for David, and David held the evidence in his hands. What are the spears and the canteens in your life? What are the things that you can point to that are unequivocally evidence of God's faithfulness in your life? What are the things that you can look to in times of trial as encouragement of God's working, even when you are experiencing setbacks and can't see how your troubles will be resolved? It could be a thing that you keep as a reminder of God's faithfulness. It could be a true story that you tell. It could be the life of someone that God has used in your life. Look at these things in times that are ripe for discouragement, and then look past them to God and remember what He has done. Over the next few verses, David addressed Saul directly, in much the same way that he did after the incident in the cave back in chapter 24. But here I want to focus on verse 19. And our heading here is loss. Despite the encouragement that God had given to David, David still felt the loss that was associated with his circumstances. And we shouldn't pretend otherwise. We can receive encouragement, but that doesn't preclude grief or pain or any of the suffering that comes along with trials. So David said, first, if the Lord has stirred you up against me, let's deal with that with an offering. But if it is men, may they be cursed. Well, it wasn't really men so much as it was a man. It was Saul himself who had stirred himself up against David. But then David expressed his complaint. This was the suffering that David was most affected by. It wasn't that he had to sleep in the caves in the wilderness. It wasn't that he was constantly looking over his shoulder, wondering where Saul's army was. It wasn't even that he had to leave his wife in the middle of the night in order to escape Saul, and that she had since been given to another man. It was that, at least for a time, David could have no share in the heritage of the Lord. It was that he was effectively being told, you're not welcome here. So just go serve other gods. Now, what's he talking about here? Well, he couldn't go to the tabernacle. He could not participate in the public worship of Yahweh. That was the heritage that he wasn't able to share in, at least for that time. That's what it means when he says, they're telling me to go serve other gods. And for David, that was the greatest loss that he experienced in this whole thing. At this point, I'm going to digress a little bit, because I want to share something with you that's related, but it's also something that's a bit of an aside. Worshiping God is among the greatest privileges that we enjoy. That He would accept our worship. That He has given us a standing in Christ that allows us to worship Him. Now, we worship God privately. We can and should glorify God in all that we do. Anything that is done in submission to Him is an act of worship. And David was able to worship God no matter where he was. And so are we. But there's also public worship. There's corporate worship, what we're doing right now. And God has instituted certain ways that we are called to worship Him publicly. There were certain ones that were in effect in the Old Testament, and they have, to some degree, changed in the New Testament. Today, He calls us to worship Him publicly through prayer, through singing, through giving offerings, through the reading and teaching of His Word, through baptism, and through the Lord's Supper, which we're going to participate in, to partake of later in the service. We are commanded and privileged to worship God in both ways, privately and publicly. And just because you worship him privately does not mean that you're excused from worshiping him publicly in a gathering of believers like this one. I want to digress just a bit further for a moment and explain to you why it is that we are as open as we are here at Trinity Bible Church when it comes to participation in the Lord's Supper. I'm very aware that there are other gatherings of believers, faithful believers, who share a lot in common with us, who are not so open. And I understand in many cases why they're not. Because it is a concern that people would partake of the Lord's Supper in an unworthy manner. And they very much desire for that not to happen. The Apostle Paul warned us in 1 Corinthians not to do that. And he warned us about the potential consequences. He even said that people were becoming sick, and in some cases even dying, because they partook of the Lord's Supper in an unworthy manner. So I understand why they discourage people who they cannot confirm from partaking of the Lord's Supper. But the possibility that I would mistakenly prevent someone who has been redeemed by the Lord's blood and who is prepared to partake in a worthy manner from engaging in this act of worship, that I would inadvertently prevent him or her from worshiping God in this way, that is something that I am not willing to do. Because I believe that if I were ever guilty of that, it would be no different from the people that prevented David, Saul in particular, from partaking of the Lord's heritage and sharing in public worship in Israel at that time. To stop a true act of authentic public worship would be a sin, both against the individual believer who was prevented from partaking, but also against God, who would not receive that worship. So it is a matter of conviction to me that we do not attempt to weed out the tares from this worship, and in doing so, risk dislodging even one stalk of wheat. Now, getting back to David, he felt this loss greatly, and he expressed that loss. And so when you experience a setback, when the trials continue to rage in your life, well, we've seen, persevere. Look for encouragement in God's faithfulness, both past and present. But don't feel that you need to deny the reality of the suffering that you are experiencing today. In the remaining verses, we see David's hope in the face of trials. His hope wasn't in Saul. Saul said, "I have not sinned. Return, my son David, for I will do you no harm." But David doesn't return. Ralph Davis says, "Just because Saul has been a fool, there's no reason for David to be one." Yeah, right, David thought. Here's the spear, O king. Just send a young man over to get it. Saul's words were empty. His assurances were meaningless. And even if he meant any of it when he said it, which I think is doubtful, he would forget it soon enough. But David had someone better to put his hope in. He trusted in the Lord. "May the Lord deliver me out of all tribulation." Now, when David says all tribulation, he's not saying that he expects that once God deals with Saul, that David's life is going to be free of trial. And it certainly won't be. And if we eventually study 2 Samuel, we're going to see that. What David is saying here is, first, that any true deliverance from any tribulation at all comes only from the Lord. No matter what trial you're facing, large or small, God is your hope. And David also knows that there is another life coming. That is the real hope. And there, deliverance will be complete and permanent. Then Saul says to David, "Blessed be you, my son David. You will do many things and will succeed in them." So David went his way, and Saul returned to his place. So God delivered David, and not just from Saul, but from discouragement, from despair. In the face of setback, David persevered. He found encouragement in God's faithful. He freely acknowledged his loss, and he put his hope in God. And there is the example for us. Let's pray.